Hello. Welcome to a webinar sponsored by MomsFightingAutism.com. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira. I will be your moderator this evening. And my guest is Ann Palmer. Ann Palmer has 13 years' experience working with families of individuals with autism at Division Teach and has coordinated a volunteer parent mentor program at 5 Teach centers across the state of North Carolina. Ms. Palmer is currently Director of Chapter Relations for the Autism Society of North Carolina, and she coordinates over 40 parent support groups throughout the state. Ann is also the parent of a 27-year-old person who has been through college and who is on the autism spectrum. She is also an author of 2 books, and she is going to be speaking to us this evening about succeeding in college with autism or Asperger syndrome. Hello, Ann.
Good evening, Chantal.
Welcome to the webinar.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here tonight.
Well, I should maybe explain to the listeners that we first met, I think it was in Arizona a few years ago at a national conference for the Autism Society of America.
That's right.
And we were both presenting on our different topics. Mine was on adolescence and yours was on succeeding in college. Did you want to mention what the names are of the 2 books that you have published so far?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My first book was Realizing the College Dream with Autism or Asperger Syndrome, A Parent's Guide to Student Success. And that one was published in 2005. And since that one came out, I also co-authored a book called Parenting Across the Autism Spectrum, Unexpected Lessons We've Learned. And I co-authored that with Maureen Morrell, another parent of an adult son with autism.
Oh, can you tell me a little bit more about that particular book, since we will be talking about the succeeding in college with autism or Asperger syndrome?
Yes, thank you. This book we wrote to try to put together something for parents of, it could be for any age child, any functioning level, at any time in their lives, but we primarily wanted to have something that is inspiring and hopeful for parents of newly diagnosed children. Maureen Morrell is the parent of an adult son with very severe autism and mental retardation, and he has done very well for himself in his life, though very different from my son, who is on the higher end of the autism spectrum. And what we put together are sort of the lessons that we've learned over the 30 years of parenting our children that we wish we had known when they were first diagnosed at the age of 3. So just sort of some advice for parents and some of our life experiences that have helped us over the years and might help these parents of newly diagnosed children.
Well, hindsight is 20/20, isn't it, Ann?
Yes, definitely.
Well, I find it interesting, and I think it's really great that 2 parents with 2 different types of young adults or adults on the spectrum have written that kind of book, because that's the whole thing about autism, is it is a spectrum, and also what works with one person may not necessarily work exactly the same for somebody else, but we still have to pull on the same attitudes about having a child or a teenager or young adult with autism that we're helping get ready for the real world.
Exactly. Maureen and I met each other at a mother support group over 20 years ago, and we were both the deer with the headlights, the deer in the headlights look on our faces when we were first trying to figure out how to help our sons. And even though our sons have very different challenges and strengths, a lot of what we were going through as parents, grieving and learning to be better advocates for our kids, a lot of those experiences were very similar. And a lot of the emotions that we were going through as parents over the years have been very similar. And I've learned a great deal from her experiences with her son, even though they were very different from my own with my son. So I'm a very big proponent of families, parents, helping each other, supporting each other, no matter where their children fall on the autism spectrum. We're really all in this together, and we can all learn from each other.
Very good points that you make there, Anne. And while we're talking about inspirational stories, I'm not sure how many of our listeners know out there that there has been in production for some time a movie based on the life of Temple Grandin, and it's actually now going to premiere on February 6th on HBO.
That should be a great movie. We're actually having some sort of a premiere here in North Carolina, and I'm expected to be there, so I'm really looking forward to that.
That's good. Well, I actually am lucky enough to have received a review copy because I'm going to be writing an article for the Huffington Post on the movie, and I have to say I was very nervous about watching it because, first of all, well, we all know who Temple Grandin is, so it's hard to imagine a movie. You want to make sure that all the details are right when you know somebody that well.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, she's a good friend of mine, and I thought, what am I going to do if I don't like the movie or if I don't like the way it's acted out or it's portrayed? Because I also have a TV and film background, so I kind of look at things a little bit differently as well. And I thought, I can't lie to Temple if I don't like this movie. What am I going to do? Especially Temple, because she's so forthright.
Right.
And, you know, she doesn't lie. And so I was so thrilled when I saw the movie, and I can't say enough good things about it. It's amazing. And Temple had a lot of input into the movie. So it's very inspirational, and that's a tip out there to parents. It doesn't matter where your child is on the spectrum, this is a movie to see. For professionals and even for people who have no interest in autism, it's just a great movie. Because it is very inspirational. It's great about life in general, and there are so many lessons to be learned in there that can be applied to anyone. So enjoy it when it comes out, when you go to the premiere, Anne.
Wonderful. I'll look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, so now to tonight's topic, succeeding in college with autism or Asperger's syndrome. What was your inspiration behind writing that book?
Well, when my son was first accepted into college, I suddenly realized, you know, that what I didn't know about this transition and what was going to be ahead of him. And I looked out in the books and the literature for something that was already written about helping these students transition into college, what they would need to know to do, and especially something from a parent's perspective, because I was scared to death. And actually, there was nothing, very little available in the literature. And then there weren't that many friends that I had, personal friends, with sons or daughters who had been through that process that I could go to with my questions. And so I thought, you know, this is a struggle for me as a parent. I would love to be able to give something to parents coming behind me who are also having the same questions and the same worries and need the same information. So that was sort of my inspiration, and my son inspired me over the 5 years he was in college, and I wanted to be able to share some of his success with other parents and hopefully give them some hope about the college and how successful it can be for our kids.
So you basically figured it out while you were helping him or mentoring him through the process?
That's right. I had a couple people I went to for a little bit of advice, but overall what I've included in the book covers my experiences as a parent of an elementary school child all the way through high school, what I learned through that process that he would need at the college level, what things I didn't do for him that I probably should have helped him with and in his younger years to prepare for this. And then a lot of the book is actually on his experiences in college and with the experiences over the years that I've heard from other parents. I do a lot of work with families. I developed a parent mentor program at the Teach program and did that for 14 years. And through that process, I met a lot of parents who had kids who were transitioning to college as well, and so their experiences are also a part of what I wrote in the book. But yes, I kind of learned as I went along about the trials and tribulations and the success, the things that we did that were right, the things, the mistakes he made that we learned from. And I just wanted to share some of that information to other families so hopefully they could learn from it as well.
Yeah, now it's interesting because my son Jeremy is finishing high school and he is going to be starting at community college, and so I've had to do also my own investigation, and of course your book has been helpful to me. But for our listeners out there, I think that we need to maybe bring up a little bit about the difference from high school and mm-hmm. college, at least in the terms of, I don't know if your son had an IEP or not. Did he have an IEP?
He did. He did. All the way through school, he had an IEP.
I think that one thing that's pretty clear that parents need to know is that when your child is in high school and he's under IDEA, they have the rights to accommodations and modifications. But when they go on to college, there's a few major differences. I don't know if you want to bring them up.
Well, I'll be happy to. I can talk about some of them, and if I leave out something, please add what you're learning through your process. But you're right in that the high school experience is quite different. The law that the federal law that protects students in higher education and in the workplace is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is there also to protect students like the IDEA did, but there are no IEPs in college. And a student has to qualify academically to get into college, whereas in public schools, as you know, they have to serve our children, even if they're struggling, even if they need a lot of help. Legally, they serve our kids with supports. The college level, they don't have to serve our children, and they can't modify the curriculum, change it for the student with any kind of disability to give them any kind of unfair advantage. So at the college level, it's more about treating that student as an adult, as a self-advocate, and not working directly with the parents, which is what we do with our children all the way through school. We're primarily the main advocate for our kids. But at the college level, they're considered adults, and they're treated as such. And parents have very little involvement at the college level in advocating for their son or daughter.
Right. Those are the two major points. Is number one is that there are no modifications, only accommodations, and you have to prove that you need those accommodations, and you have to be able to ask for the accommodations. And secondly, it's not the parents that have to be asking, it's the student. And in fact, if the student is 18 or over, the parents have no rights to see any paperwork or anything of that sort. They always deal with the student. Is that not correct, Anne?
That's absolutely correct. And that was the biggest adjustment I had as a parent, and I think most parents go through. It's very important for parents to understand this change in our role. And if they do understand it, hopefully that transition can go smoother because we're really so used to being the behind-the-scenes person advocating for what our son or daughter needs. We know our children best, but at the college level, they're focusing on independence. And they can bring a parent into discussions, but only if the student asks for the parent to be involved and actually signs a waiver that allows information to be shared with the parents. It's totally based on the student's request to do that. And any accommodation that I may think my son might need in college, I can't call the disability services person and say, my son needs a note taker. My son would have to go to that person and say, I need a note taker, and this is why. They actually have to ask and tell why they need it. And that's very hard for a lot of our students on the autism spectrum to be able to do.
And that goes back to knowing sooner so that you can prepare, because first of all, they have to be able to advocate for themselves. And secondly, part of that advocacy means being able to recognize where they need help.
Exactly. And that's not always a real easy thing for these students to recognize as well. And I think that's where parents play a vital role, even if we are kind of behind the scenes when our children are in a higher education. We're advising them, we're reminding them, we're pointing out to them where they're struggling. And sometimes they don't actually see where they are, where they need help. And that's where I think parents have a very strong role in trying and keeping up with how our son or daughter is doing in college and helping advise them about when to ask for help and how to do that.
Now, though, wouldn't you say that since the high school is really the transition years when we're getting our guys ready for real life, is there a way to include self-advocacy as part of their IEP so that they're learning these skills in preparation for college?
I think so. It, you know, in my opinion, what you're working on a lot of the time in middle school and high school are communication skills, asking for help, working in a group. These are all kind of communication, interpersonal skills that will help the student be able to ask for help and to communicate with others. The college student with any disability has to be able to communicate with their professor about their needs and their strengths. So this is an important skill to learn, and you start it early. You don't wait until the year before they're graduating from high school to work on how to ask for help. I think students in high school can be given certain tasks or things, goals in their IEP, such as maybe reporting something to an office, to a teacher, working in volunteering in an office on campus like the library or the guidance office, where they're having to communicate with people, where they're having to follow instructions and ask for things. Any of those kind of skills that you can work on in the high school setting will help build on those self-advocacy skills in college.
Very good points. So what are the most important things that you would tell a parent about getting your child ready for college? I mean, you talked right now about the communication skills and the advocacy skills. Are there other things?
I think it's very important. We tend to, when we have a son or daughter who has a lot of academic skills, we're so thrilled that our kids can do well academically. And I understand the pride we have in our student who can do calculus in middle school, but if they can't go into McDonald's and order their lunch and know if they got the right change back, you've missed something there. So what I would emphasize to parents, don't forget the functional skills, the self-help skills, things that the student will need to do whether they go to higher education or not. They're going to need to be able to take care of themselves physically. They're going to need to stay safe in whatever community they're in. They're going to need to communicate their needs and their challenges and ask for help. So I would remind parents to put goals in that transition plan related to functional skills. And these can include anything from taking care of their self-help skills or driving or riding a bus or taking care of their financial needs using a debit card. These are things we often aren't thinking about at the IEP meeting in school. These are things often that parents have to do outside of school for their sons and daughters, but they're equally as important, I believe, as the academic skills that these students might need at the college level.
Another thing that I hear a lot about back from parents is that a lot of times when they get to college, they get lost in terms of their organizational skills and timelines, because when you're in high school, you go every day to school. You know, usually you tend to go from, 9 to 3, for example. Mm-hmm. And you might have different classes if you're on a block system, but basically there's a schedule. Well, when you go to college, perhaps you're only taking a couple of classes, but it's not always every day the same time that you go to school and that you come back. And the other thing is there's a lot more independent work, and the teachers aren't prompting you to do the work. See, and so the person has to be really able to schedule their time when they're studying and looking forward into, okay, this project is due on this date. How am I going to divide up the work until then?
Right.
What thoughts do you have about that, Anne?
Well, I think I agree with you totally that is definitely an issue. And I think it's very individualized because all of our sons and daughters are different and may have different kinds of organizational skills or challenges. But in my experience with my own son and with every parent I've ever talked to, all of our children struggle in some way with organizational skills. So I would recommend that you start getting the student learning to use whatever form a calendar that works for them. Have them using one in high school that will prepare them for using one in college, whether it's on an electronic device or whether it's on their computer, whether it's in an actual physical calendar. But find the organizational strategies that work best for that particular student. Help them organize the papers they get back. The grades, help them figure out a way to chart the grades they're making in classes. That's one area that my son struggled with in college. He didn't realize when he was flunking a class because he wasn't able to retain the grades he was making over that term. So we came up with a strategy of a notebook where he put in his grades for every test that was returned or every paper that was returned, and that served as sort of a prompt for him about how he was doing in the classes. So calendars are big and important to get used to using early because you're right, you're having to organize yourself in much different ways than you do at the high school level, and you have a lot of downtime as a college student between classes. And many assignments are long-term. Professors are not giving you reminders about where you should be in your reading and where you should be on these long-term assignments. So you need to break them down on a calendar to give yourself some targets to work towards in order to get the material done in the period of time it's required.
Very good tips. May I ask what your son is doing now?
Well, Eric graduated from college probably, 3 years ago, and he is now working full-time at a veterinary school here in North Carolina at the same university he attended. His main interest in life is animals and has always been animals, so he's in a great environment working with people who also love animals. It's a full-time job with benefits, and we're thrilled that he has this job. He's living independently in his own apartment. He still requires support. He doesn't drive, so we transport him to doctor's appointments in the grocery store and things like that, though he does handle his finances and pays his rent and his bills. He rides a bus to and from work. He is still quite autistic, kind of an odd guy, doesn't have a lot of friends, but he's very happy, and he has a very full life, and we're thrilled that he's been able to accomplish as much as he has.
That's great. What kind of work does he do there? Does he get to interact with animals very much?
He does some of the day. I wish he had a job that was fully working directly with animal care. For the moment, he is working a large part of the day in what's called a washroom, where the cages that the animals are in have to come through and be disinfected and cleaned and run through a big machine. And amazingly, as someone on the autism spectrum, he deals with a loud, hot, smelly kind of environment and is able to do this job. But then they also realize he needs to have more one-on-one time with animals, and they pull him out during the day to feed some of the animals they use in the research, to socialize with some of the animals. So he's having a combination of those two jobs right now, and I would love for him to move more towards the direct animal care part, and that may be something he can work towards in future years.
Sounds great, though, that he has a job like that with benefits, and they seem to really take him and his needs into consideration.
They do, and they know he has autism, and they've been very welcoming. One thing I have found is that people who care about animals are often very accepting people of differences and people's strengths and challenges, and I think they are very welcoming to him, and I'm very thankful for that.
That's great. I'm happy that he is there.
Me
okay.
<too. laughs>
I'm sure it's a load off your back.
Well, and, you know, I think we found this job from a friend of a friend who knew someone who worked there who had hired an individual with a disability before. So I think oftentimes as we look towards job opportunities for our children, it's often who you know and who might have connections in jobs of interest to our kids. And I think we were fortunate, very fortunate, to find the right people, and that's why it's so important, I think, for families and the student to really network and to find out who might be out there who can provide this kind of an opportunity for the student on the autism spectrum, because I really feel like there are people who would be happy to hire our children because they often make such great employees, and it's just a process of opening that door and making the introduction, and usually our kids can do very well.
Right. That's true. Good comment. Should we start with some questions?
Sure.
Okay, so here's Vicki from Patton, and she asks, is it better for the college student to identify themselves as having autism or Asperger's syndrome to the instructors at the beginning of each semester, or is that dependent upon how the student can handle their individual course load?
I think the answer to that has to be based on individualizing, of course, for each student, because they are different. They are all different. I think disclosing may be important, especially in situations where the application for college might not be as strong as you would like. So maybe you would disclose to explain some of the weaknesses in the student's background before coming to college. However, disclosure is not an all or nothing decision. And I think that's one thing we need to emphasize to our sons and daughters, that they don't have to necessarily disclose to everyone on a college campus. They may only disclose to disability services, or they may only disclose to one professor. We had a situation with my son where he was scheduled to take a class called interpersonal communication. Well, obviously, students on the autism spectrum often have trouble with interpersonal communication, and I knew this would be a course that would be hard for my son. At that point, up to that point, he had not disclosed to his professors, and he had attended, this was his second year of college. And we talked about it and talked about how in this particular situation it might be beneficial for the professor to understand my son better and to understand his difficulty that he had with interpersonal communications. And at that point, my son decided to disclose, and he decided to disclose to all of his professors. And that was his choice. And I do want to emphasize to the parents that the whether or not to disclose is the student's choice. Again, we can advise, but we can't direct them to disclose if they're really against disclosing. And it really is their decision, and they are actually the only ones at the college level who can disclose about their disability. So, I just think it's a personal situation, everybody's own decision about what they feel comfortable doing, but I personally believe that disclosure can only help the student rather than harm them in any way.
Yeah, well, isn't it Stephen Shore who says that disclosure is dependent on whether or not your needs are met? So if your needs are not being met and you need something, for example, if you need some accommodation to be successful at school, then you need to at least disclose to the disability person why you would need such an accommodation.
Yes, that's right. And how much you disclose can vary as well. And maybe you don't need to give the definition from the DSM-4 of Asperger's syndrome, but you can explain a difficulty you have in communication or socially or working with groups. There are different ways of disclosing your needs without giving your whole life history. And then, again, you choose who you disclose to, at how much information you give, and it doesn't have to be verbal. That's one way my son decided to disclose to his professors by a written disclosure, and that was much more comfortable for him to be able to describe his personal needs and his learning style, and that was much easier for him to hand to a professor or to email to a professor rather than going into their office and striking up a conversation about his autism. So there are different ways to do it, and I really encourage parents to talk through this issue with their students early. Don't wait until they're in college. It's important that they understand this option and that it can help them if they need help at the college level.
Mm-hmm. Now, does a professional need to supply a letter or some confirmation that an accommodation is needed?
Yes, and actually I would recommend that any school that a parent or family is looking at or considering, you should talk to the Disability Services Office at each of these schools. Many of them will have on their website a sort of a list of what documentation is required. But in order to receive any accommodation at the college level, the student has to qualify for that accommodation because of a disability. And so there will be some sort of a report that is required that gives the diagnosis. And whether or not it should be signed by a psychologist or a medical doctor or whatever will depend on the university and what kind of disability it is. But so check with the school first to find out what kind of paperwork is required to disclose to Disability Services.
Very good. Thank you for that, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a question from Idalia Hernandez in Chicago. How do we research and choose a college for my son with Asperger's syndrome? The City Colleges of Chicago do not provide any guidance for students with autism. My son is very high-functioning with straight A's in high school. I really need some advice as to where I should start.
Okay, well, all colleges should have a Disability Services Office if they receive any kind of federal funding money, which almost every college does. They have to have disability services available to students at their college campus. Whether the city colleges in Chicago that she mentions, I'd be surprised that there aren't some sorts of accommodations or disability services office there. Maybe they don't have a lot of experience with autism spectrum disorder students, but they would have some sort of accommodations available. But I would recommend that the family meets with that office at every school they're considering and talk to them about what kind of accommodations are possible with the diagnosis that your son or daughter has. In my book, I actually list a number of questions, possible questions you might want to ask the disability services person, because you're trying to find out not only what kind of academic accommodations there are, but are there any other supports available on the campus? Does the disability services person have experience with people and training about people with autism spectrum disorder? And I think also you want to consider a number of things when choosing a college besides the levels of supports that are available. You want to think about, does the student need to go to college close to home? Are they going to commute? Are they going to live on campus? If they are going to live on campus, do they need to be in close proximity to home for the support that the family can give them? They also want to think about the size of the school. Some of our students have sensory issues. So going to a very large campus with a very large class size might be difficult for a student who has a lot of sensory issues. So the size of the school may be important for the student. You also want to choose a college that offers a curriculum of interest to that student. It's, you know, they're going to have to take a lot of courses that are required that may not be around their interests, but you want them to be able to balance those maybe harder courses with courses that really that they would enjoy and do well in. And then also, like I mentioned, you want to find out what services that college has possible for students with ASD.
Right. Now, I know from having received emails from people and then looking into it, it really does depend where you are located. Mm-hmm. But it's true that all colleges have some sort of disability services because of the federal law.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that not all colleges are really used to Asperger's or don't have an understanding. They're more used to the type of disability where someone shows up in a wheelchair or with a cane, but
right.
not someone that has processing difficulties or perhaps can't handwrite, so they need to actually type everything out, or that need more time processing. And so I've noticed that that's the kind of issues that seem to happen in the at least the community college level in certain areas. And it's right now the way we used to advocate when our kids were younger, we now have to advocate at the college level. Have you been getting feedback sort of like that as well?
I have. But one thing I've noticed, I present quite often to the head organization, Association for Higher Education and Disabilities, and at those presentations, the audience is primarily disability services folks who work at community colleges and larger universities around the country. And what I'm seeing is that the interest in learning more about students with ASD is growing, and that these
Great.
Disability services person are realizing that they may not be as prepared for these students coming as they would have liked, and they're pretty hungry for information about our kids. So I'm finding that it's changing, that you're right, there are disability services people who are used to working with more the classically physically disabled students, but there is a trend that's changing as we see more and more of our kids being able to go into higher education. These individuals are needing the supports through the disability services, and they're having to adjust their knowledge base. And so I'm excited about the fact that they're learning more, that they're having more students, and hopefully that they're becoming more aware of the needs of students with ASD.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it, too. Okay, here's Joanne in San Diego. I have been looking for a way to assess my daughter for a career. The assessments given are all based on self-evaluation questions, which, as you know all too well, self-evaluation is not the best method to assess those on the spectrum. How do I direct my 20-year-old who is in college to take classes that best fit her not yet discovered career goal? Looking for assessments in San Diego or an online parent assessment for the best field to enter her into if you have suggestions.
Well, that's a very good question, actually, and I think that, too, is changing and improving. I think in the past, the vocational rehabilitation folks through our school system, their ways of assessing vocational skills and behaviors and needs was not really appropriate all the time for students on the higher end of the autism spectrum. It didn't really get to the needs of these students and the interests of these students. But one of the best assessment tools that I've seen, and again, you know, everyone has their own opinion about what works well, but one of the best assessment tools and a more recent one that's come out is the TTAP. It's the Teach Transition Assessment Profile, and this is a very extensive evaluation assessment of that could be appropriate for students from fifth grade on and through adulthood, and it includes a number of an hour and a half, I think, of direct observation of the student, and then multiple hours of interviews with someone, a caregiver in the home situation, and or someone in the work situation or the school situation. So it's not just a self-assessment. They're actually observing, they're testing the student for the different functional, independent functioning. They're testing the student on leisure skills, on vocational skills, vocational behavior, functional communication, interpersonal behavior. So they're really looking at the whole piece, in my mind, of some of our strengths and challenges of these students. And it gives a much more accurate, I believe, assessment of what's possible for that student and where are their needs and what should we be working on to help them achieve their goals. So that's one assessment. Chantal, you may know of something more in the California area, but that is one of the more dominant assessment tools here in North Carolina that's used for students with ASD.
I'm not that familiar with assessments in terms of at the college level, but I will say for this person who's based in San Diego that I know an educational psychologist who has worked with students in college, and if I don't know if this person could be helpful, but she might know of those types of assessments. And so I'm going to give my email address now, and if Joanne or anyone else who wants that wants to email me, I'll be happy to send you the contact information for this educational psychologist. Her name is Deborah Plotkins. And my email address is my last name without the hyphen, and I'm going to spell it for you after I say it. It's CecileKira@mac.com, and that's spelled SicileKira at mac.com. My name again is SicileKira, and that's at mac.com. So hopefully, if this person doesn't have or isn't able to help, I'm sure she would know where to send people for information about assessments here in San Diego.
Great.
Okay, this is Marcy in Encinitas. My son is only in sixth grade, but I am already getting anxious about him being able to graduate from high school and go on to college. We toured my alma mater over the summer, and it really sparked his interest. What is the best way for us to start setting the course for him to succeed at this?
Well, my first reaction before I answer the question is to remind the parent not to be too anxious, that it's very easy to be anxious about the future for our kids, but I want to remind her that our children are lifelong learners, and your son is in sixth grade, and there are going to be all kinds of skills that your son will develop over the years. So it's impossible at this point to really predict what he will be able to accomplish and what the future will hold. So, you know, it's easy to get worried about our kids' future, and I understand personally I did the same thing, but I think it's also good to remind ourselves that time will teach him many things, and he may develop the skills that you imagine now are impossible. I think one thing I would suggest to this parent is to work on those skills in middle school and high school. As I mentioned this before, that he's going to need as an adult, not just the academic, to again work on the social, the communication skills, the life skills, help the student. I think one of the most important things you can do is to help the student accept and understand their disability, not only their strengths and what they do well, but their challenges, and to be able and feel comfortable asking for help. I think some of the saddest stories that I hear of students going to college and failing are those students who need assistance but do not want to ask for assistance or help because they don't want to be singled out in any way. And so the most we can do as a parent to help our sons and daughters feel comfortable with who they are, the good, the bad, the challenges, the strengths, the better they will do at the college level, I believe. And also start putting some goals in the IEP, I think, for this mom. Maybe think about some of those organizational skills they're going to need that they may not have, or those communication skills, and put some goals in the student's IEP to help build on those skills and to help them be a good self-advocate. I have an article on my website that may be of help to this particular mom. My website is www.AnnPalmerAutism, that's all one word, .com. And on that website is an article called Surviving Middle School with an Included Child with Autism. So that gives a number of organizational strategies at the middle school level that may be appropriate for her son, who's now in middle school, I believe.
Right. But you're right. You can start some groundwork on things that are going to be needed later on, because they're life skills, regardless of whether they go into college or to work. They need those self-advocacy skills and those communication skills. And I think the most important thing, too, is that they realize their strengths and their deficits, and they know that it's okay that they're not perfect, or no one's perfect. And so they have to recognize, everyone has to recognize that we all need help. It doesn't matter whether we're on the spectrum or not. And
yeah.
It's recognizing how to ask for help. And another great skill to teach is networking. Because as Anne was talking about earlier, how that's how we get work, that's a skill that doesn't come naturally to people on the spectrum. And networking starts with learning about how to ask for help. So as they get older and they're living on their own and they have need of a plumber, how do you find a plumber? Well, do you just look in the Yellow Pages, or do you remember that, oh, you saw a plumber's truck at your neighbor's down the street? Well, you're going to find out, did that plumber do a good job? You'll just call that plumber if it worked out. You know, people with autism don't think about those kinds of things, but that's how people get help for themselves. That's how things work in a community.
Exactly. And I think that we can, as parents, it's a constant learning field here as we're seeing how we make decisions, how we take care of ourselves and advocate for ourselves and our children. We can teach things like that to our children from elementary school on, just by talking about the experience they just had and what they learned from it, and what, you know, how we made that decision. These are ways that we can work on those self-advocacy skills that you're describing. And I want to also suggest that, you know, it's okay that when your child is in sixth grade to not know what's coming, and to not know if college is even going to be possible. I didn't consider college. I did, like many parents did when my son was diagnosed at the age of two. I gave up the idea of college. That was part of my grieving process that I went through, coming to terms with accepting who my son was. And I think it wasn't until eighth grade, when I think they sent a form home from school that had, we were supposed to sign up for the courses he would take in high school in ninth grade. And I needed to decide at that point, would he be on a college track? And that was the first time I ever seriously considered it. And at eighth grade, he would never have had the skills to do what he was able to do when he went to college. So a lot happened between eighth grade and 12th grade, and that will happen with all of our kids. There's a lot of growth, physical and maturity and academic growth. Everything is on a growth curve in those years, and you really can't possibly predict. So if you're the parent of a ninth grader now and you're thinking this all sounds extremely impossible for my son or daughter to be able to do, in 3 years, a lot can change and a lot could be possible. And, people need to leave that door open in case that is a door that your son or daughter will go through.
And I want to add two comments to that. And the first one is, there are a lot of neurotypical people that don't go to college either.
Right.
So college does not mean, you know, look at all the people that went to college that don't have jobs to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily something bad if your child never goes to college, and it's too early to really worry about that in sixth grade. Just as Anne said, anything can happen. And the second point I would like to make is to give the example of my son, who is severely impacted by autism, who spells out on a letterboard or on a light writer. He passed the California exit exam on his first try. We gave it to him as a baseline. And now he's finishing his classes. I never thought he would graduate from high school. That was not a goal for my son and my mind at all. I never thought he would. And it was the new director of special education who said, oh, your child has X number of credits. Have you ever thought about him graduating? And we had thought, well, maybe he'll go for the GED, because we didn't know until recently how much he really understood of what was going on around him. And they said, no, well, you know, he could actually graduate from high school if he can pass the California exit exam, which is a test that's given to everyone here in 10th grade, and you have 6 tries to pass it. Well, they just gave it to him when he was 19, and he passed it on the first try.
Great.
Okay? So now he's finishing, and now he's going. Actually, that's where I was today for the first meeting at the community college. I just went in the background, but he went with his support person, because now Jeremy needs a communication partner or support person with him, which is harder but easier in a way, because it's obvious that he needs somebody with him. But again, he has no modifications of the work. He only has accommodation in that, you know, he has a note taker, and he has the right to use different letter boards, mm-hmm. and he has extended time on his exams. But other than that, he has to do the same amount of work as everybody. But here's the caveat with my son, and, you know, it really pains me because I would like him to be very independent. I've managed to get him to the point where we know that he's smart and he can do all this work, and he loves to learn and he writes. That's what he wants to do. He wants to write. But because of his motor difficulties, it's really hard for him to do a lot of sequencing and to finish a lot of tasks that are needed for independent skill living. And that's our big struggle all the time, you know. Mm. And it's really hard, but it's more like as if somebody who had CP or motor difficulty, it really, so we still struggle with that. It has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with motor control and motor initiation and all these areas that we take for granted that we can just move our bodies. But for some people like Jeremy, it's really difficult. But anyway, the point is, you never know. Our life totally changed within 3 years in terms of direction for what my son might be capable of doing. And in terms of him, it's really improved his quality of life because he loves to learn. That's his number one thing at the moment.
Well, that's a great interest and skill to have, actually. It's wonderful.
Exactly. Okay, now here's... Here's a person, Joy in Irvine. My young adult son with Asperger's syndrome is going to junior college again in a few weeks, and he needs an aide to help him with studying, staying on task, organizing his work, and to communicate with the professor. Where would I find this person? How much would he get paid, and what educational background should he have to do this job?
Well, first of all, the disability services folks on the college campus can help a little bit with some of that. They should be able to help with some of the organizational skills, setting up some ways for the student to better organize himself and do his task. And also, they often can be involved in educating the professors, raising their awareness about the autism spectrum, and possibly helping the student disclose or explain to the professors their needs. So some of that can be done within the school setting without having to hire an outside person. But, you know, not at all colleges are they... you know, willing to do that, have the time to do that, have the expertise to do that. But there are paid coaches that are out there. I think they're often called life skills coaches or college coaches. And we have some in this area, not a lot. Many are psychologists who do this as part of their practice, or they might be, in terms of educational level, they typically are counselors or psychologists. but somebody, you want somebody who has a lot of experience with the autism spectrum, because the needs of these students can be very different from the needs of another student with another kind of learning disability. So you want them to have that experience. Here in North Carolina, the college coach that we have in this area, who's very good, I think her fees are typically can be like $50 an hour, and she's available to maybe help students and their families in the transition part between high school and college to help prepare them for the skills they're going to need. And then she also has a number of students she works with who are in college now, and she meets with them on a regular basis, helps them look at their calendar, do their schedule, advocate, help them learn the best ways to advocate for themselves and how to deal with some of the social and sensory, different kind of issues that come up on a college campus. So I think, you know, what you'll need to do, what this parent will need to do is kind of research it a little bit, see if there are any local psychologists who offer this service. And then also ask the colleges you're considering, if there is a counseling office there, they may offer some of this support that they could possibly help the student as well.
Good point. Here's a question from Dave Hamilton in York, Pennsylvania, and I love this question. My child, adult, has succeeded in college. What do I do now?
That's a very good question. I've thought it was very interesting over the years when I have heard adults on the autism spectrum talk about college and talk about what comes next, and many of them speak of college as sort of a nirvana, where they're in an environment that is somewhat protected, and they're in an environment where they can study to their heart's content topics that really interest them. And to many of these adults, this is a wonderful environment to be in, and they thrive in this environment. However, they also speak to the fact that once they're finished with college, and many go on to grad school because this environment is so attractive and comfortable for them, and then when they have to get a job, they end up having a lot of difficulty. So I think that's a very important question. What I personally did when my son, one way you prepare, and I did this starting in middle school on, is I made sure that my son had some sort of volunteer work, preferably in an animal-related field. So if you can, you know, figure out your son or daughter's interests and get them some sort of work experience. And typically, volunteer work is a great way to get the foot in the door, where they're not having to pay you, but they're willing to have you come in and volunteer some time. And even the parent can go with the student to the volunteer work, which is what I did with my son initially. And that gets the student to have some experience in what a job is all about and helps them work a little bit on those work skills that they're going to need. I also had the benefit of having a job coach for my son initially, and I don't know what's available in Dave's area where he lives, but I would research a job coach, what job coach resources are out there in his community that he might be able to tap into. The job coach serves a wonderful role in being able to work directly with the graduate of college in transitioning them into a workplace. So they might help find a job. They might help with some of the training that the student, the individual is going to need to do that job. They can go in and communicate with the administration of the job, the boss, to sort of talk about the individual coming into work. There's a lot of ways a job coach can be a great resource for a student or an individual with ASD transitioning into a job. So that's one option that may or may not be appropriate for his son. And then what I mentioned earlier about it's who you know. I think Dave, I would suggest to Dave that he network with other families in the autism community where he lives, find out who knows someone who might run a business who would be interested in hiring his son or daughter. So network and find out what's out there. And then lastly, the there's a wonderful book. It's Temple Grandin and Kate Duffy's book, Developing Talents. And I'm sure you're familiar with this book, Chantal,
yes.
But it's a wonderful book that really helps in a lot of those same kind of question that Dave is asking, how to determine what your skills, your interests are, what kind of job would be a good fit for you, and then how to go about finding a job in that area and how to present yourself, what to think about in terms of job behaviors and planning to skills you need to learn to be able to survive in the workplace, which can be a difficult environment for many of our loved ones with ASD. So those are some of the ideas that I have about that.
Another idea, I mean, this person doesn't give very much information, but if they succeeded in college and they made a lot of contacts in the college, there are jobs on college campuses as well.
Right.
And if it was an environment the child really, the adult child was really comfortable in, maybe that's an option as well.
I think that's a great idea. And the fact that my son works on the same college campus that he attended is very comforting to him and was a much easier transition for him because he's already familiar with the campus and he's close by to places that he's been, restaurants and social opportunities are there that he's familiar with. So it was a good transition for him to not have to go through a whole lot of changes from leaving college to going to full-time work. And I think we also need to think about, with many of our kids, that transition to work may not be best if it's to a full-time job. That may be hard for a student to go straight into a full-time job. Maybe working part-time, building up to a full-time job may be a good way for the student, the individual, to transition into the change that they're going to need to make.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a good point to make there, that I've helped a few students and parents with this aspect because a lot of employers and also a lot of parents are not really aware that their adult child may have still some of the same issues as when they were younger in terms of processing and overwhelm, and so that they get really tired from
right.
having many days on a job. And so, for example, I've been able to help with job coaches to arrange with jobs with people with Asperger's where they didn't understand. They thought maybe the person with Asperger's didn't want their job, didn't like the job because they'd end up calling in sick. But, you know, particular people maybe can only work 2 or 3 days in a row, and then they need a whole day off to recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just from all that processing and the overwhelm. And so a lot of times, as Ann said, they can't work full-time, but a lot of people don't realize that it's not a laziness thing. It really has to do with the amount of energy that it takes for the processing and the difficulties they have.
Right. And I think that when one of our loved ones gets a job and it's a good fit and they want to keep that job, they'll still need some support in order to follow up in their job, do it well, be able to work with their coworkers, be able to report to their boss, ask for help when needed. All of those skills are needed in that level as well, and I think it's important to stay involved in the individual's life as much as possible to advise, to help them see some of their challenges and understand their strengths and what they're good at. And so disclosing at a job place is very similar to that disclosing issue we talked about in college, you know, whether or not you disclose at a job interview. I really think, again, that's very individualized, and it depends on if that person can do the job without any kind of accommodations, and or are they going to totally blend with their coworkers and have the total skill set to do the job? And if not, then disclosure may be something that needs to be done. But that's where I think individuals can rely a little bit on the parent's advice in helping with that process, because it can be a tough decision.
Right. Okay, here's the letter or a question from Anna Chilcote in Big Bear. I have a 16-year-old that is autistic and MR who wants to go to college but can't pass the SATs or the PSAT. He reads at a second grade to third grade level, writes at the same level, math is the same level. He wants to work in the movie industry as an actor or movie maker at the Disney College here in California near Magic Mountain. What can I do? I'm trying to be realistic and tell him the truth, but not kill the dream.
Oh, that's a very difficult situation, and I think most of us as parents have been through something similar. When Eric was very young, he always said he wanted to be a National Geographic photographer. That was his goal. Now, he had never picked up a camera. He had no interest in taking pictures. He just really liked the idea of sitting in a tree watching lions all day or whatever. That was a dream job for him. And I remember trying to explain to him the reality of what he was suggesting. And I think I it's sort of a joke now, but I think I said something to the effect of, well, they don't sell bologna where you'd be in the safari in Africa as a National Geographic photographer. He's a very picky eater. And as soon as I said something very straightforward like that, he said, oh, okay, and he sort of moved on to something that was a little more realistic. But I think with this parent, I understand how difficult this situation is. You want to encourage the individual. You don't want to dash their dreams, but you also want them to have some realistic hopes and goals. I think community colleges nowadays offer a lot of opportunities for our kids. No matter what their abilities, academic levels are, there are life skill courses offered at community colleges for people with disabilities. Maybe that would be a way that this woman's child would be able to have a college experience. Maybe it won't be in strongly academic courses, but in more life skill kind of courses. So that would be one opportunity. I think also if I was this individual's parent, I'd be looking at the movie industry and other types of jobs or ways they could use their interest in that area that would not be the same as a movie producer or director, something that might be more realistic. What other jobs are available on a movie set that this individual could do? And I would be trying to, in whatever way they can communicate and understand, try to explain the differences to them, not focusing on what my child can't do, but on what the person in this job would need to do. And then that becomes more of a positive thing. Here's some goals to work towards, because if you want to be this person in the movie set, you need to know how to do this. And I think that's a little bit easier way to address it. It's not a perfect answer, and Chantal, maybe you have another point of view about that. I just know it's a difficult situation, and many of us have gone through it.
Well, I had an idea was that perhaps, you know, they're in Big Bear, so I don't know if this exists up there, but finding, like here in this area we're starting to get now, which only existed in L.A. before, was theater or drama or acting little groups for people on the spectrum, you know, or people with differences. And mm-hmm. So that way people can practice little different, you know, they're small productions, but you can find out what the different jobs are in, say, a theater production, and, you know, which is kind of not the same as movie, but has some things that are quite similar. And it could give a little idea of what is this like realistically. Because it could be that once he actually saw what the work was, he really wouldn't be interested.
Right.
I don't know. So that's another idea, too. But the other thing we have to keep in mind with all these kinds of situations is, yes, our kids have autism, and it's terrible, you know, for some of these things. But that kind of dream of a 16-year-old, even a neurotypical 16-year-old who is very smart, if they wanted to go work in the movie industry and be an actor or movie maker, it's still very hard. It's still not necessarily realistic, you know. I think we have a little bit of that dream here in California because we live here. But you know how many people go to Hollywood and fail. So we, as parents, I mean, we have to remember that even if they were typical, it would be a very hard thing for them to do. So,
right.
But I like the idea of trying to see if there's a theater group or something where they can, participators see what the different aspects are, and as Anne said, find out more about what other jobs there are around the industry. That because if they'd just like to be around a set, then there are maybe other jobs they can do. So good ideas there, but I don't know how realistic they are for up in Big Bear.
Yeah.
Okay, Anita in Las Vegas. What services are available in high school and college for my kids to start attending college? My son has Asperger's. He is in middle school now. Well, that kind of would be just like what you've been saying before about community colleges, right?
Right. I mean, I'm not sure if she's talking about specific accommodations. She might be talking about that, and we haven't gone into a lot of detail with that. And I know there are different programs and transition kind of programs going into a college that she may want to know about or be interested in looking up. But the main accommodations, a lot of the accommodations at the college level, whether it's a community college, university, or whatever, are going to be similar to many of the ones you know of from high school. Extended time for testing, separate setting for testing, writing in the booklet as opposed to filling in the little circles. There are some of those accommodations, and then there are a number of accommodations related to note taking, where you would actually have an assigned, you'd have someone in the class who would take notes for you, or you can tape record a lecture. So there are accommodations related to where you sit in a classroom if that's needed. Priority registration is an accommodation at the college level, a service that's there. A single dorm room is something to consider. If the student is going to live on campus, living in a dormitory can be add a lot of stress. The sensory issues, the social issues of living in a dorm, sharing a room with a relative stranger, sharing a bathroom with a number of people. These are all issues that can be challenging for a student with ASD. So maybe you look into whether a university offers a single dorm room option, which is what we used for my son, and we felt like it made a big difference in his ability to be successful in college. He had a place he could go to after a stressful day in class where he can close his door and have quiet, and it's his space and it's his time. And that was a relief for him to be able to do that. My son would not have done very well sharing a room with another person. He's not a very social person. He'd be a lousy roommate. And I think in reality, it turned out that the single room was still on a wing of a dorm, a suite in a dorm, and he was near a lot of students, could be as social as he wanted to be, but he could also close that door and have time to himself. So those are some of the accommodations to think about, to ask about. The other one that I think about is some sort of transition program, and you'll need to kind of, the parent will need to look into what's available in their area, but many of the community colleges and some of the universities now are offering transition programs where high school students can actually take a class while they're in high school at the college level, and that way they get some experience of being on that campus, of what the college level academics are like, and those kind of transition programs can be very beneficial to our students with ASD who may need a little practice before they get there.
Okay, moving right along because we've got lots of questions to answer still.
Okay.
Lori in Grand Rapids, my son has very mild Asperger's and does not receive services. In college, he hopes to play tennis. I'm not sure if I should talk to the coach ahead of time to let him know that my son sometimes has reactions to situations that are not easy to decipher or understand. I have found that in the past it is inevitable that something will come up during the season which requires the coach to be flexible and understanding in a situation where he may normally not be.
Well, I believe that anyone who is trying to support your son or daughter in a situation, whether it's a professor or a coach, a Girl Scout leader, you know, whatever the situation may be, if they can benefit from understanding more about the student, then they should be told the needs of that student. In whatever form is best and dependent on what they actually need to know. My only thing I question from this parent is that at the college level, informing the coach about the student's needs has to be done by the student, not by the parent. So when she asks about whether she should talk to the coach, she should not talk to the coach. She needs to work with her son to come up with a way to talk to the coach, to explain the information the coach needs to know to be for that student to be most successful playing tennis or whatever the situation is. So that would be my first point, is that I do believe it's important to disclose whatever is needed for that individual to know to be successful in that realm. But it needs to be done at the college level by the student, actually, and not the parent.
Right. Okay, Linda McAndrew from Bluebell. I am a parent of a 22-year-old with Asperger's syndrome. He is in college and has had difficulty with the classroom conversational dialogue that goes on between students and teachers. I have asked to sit in the classroom in the back, very inconspicuous, and have trouble almost every time I bring up the subject to the disabilities office. Although we have found a way around the situation by having him in the online division of the college. He made Phi Theta Kappa with a 3.8 QPA, or I guess that's supposed to be GPA. Why do colleges continue to prevent adequate accommodation to occur for students who need a little extra note-taking help? Also, what do you suggest? Well, if the person needs note-taking, somebody else should be doing that and not the parent. It's not the parent sitting in the back of the room that's going to be doing the accommodations, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. And I would, I'm not at all surprised that every person she's talked to about and suggested this to has been against it, because they are going to definitely frown on a parent coming into a classroom. The interesting thing about college and accommodations as opposed to modifications in high school is that accommodations are a way for leveling the playing field at the college level. So, for example, they can't alter the curriculum or give any unfair advantage to a student because of any disability. I think what the accommodations do is they make the academic environment manageable. So without fundamentally changing the curriculum. So having anyone in the classroom who is going to be taking notes for them or telling them to put their hand down, not to interrupt the teacher, or to giving any kind of advice on an ongoing basis in a classroom will definitely be frowned upon by the college. They will not allow that. And I don't know of any colleges who would. So I would suggest that this parent look into note takers, as you suggested, anything, any kind of a resource like that, an accommodation that can help the student. But the parent will not be allowed to come in, because that's sort of an unfair advantage. They will look at that as an unfair advantage for that student.
Right. That's very good comments. Here's from Emily in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Are there any books on Asperger's syndrome for working adults? My son is graduating from college but terrified to go out on the workforce. He waited 5 years to finish his degree because he knows that when he finishes, he has to have a change and find a job.
Hmm. Well, there are books out there, and, you know, Chantal, you may know, I know your books are a good resource for parents. I think the books by Stephen Shore and the books by Temple Grandin in particular are especially helpful in directly relating to students with ASD. They're written by individuals with ASD in the workforce, How to Advocate. Stephen Shore's wonderful book about advocacy, and you'll need to remind me of the title of that.
Gosh.
It starts with Tell. You're right. I can maybe
ask
look
and
at
tell?
It.
Is it Ask
yes, that
and
sounds right. Ask and Tell is a wonderful book about disclosure, but also about, you know, how to get ready for a job and work with co-workers and things like that. And the one, the Developing Talents book that I mentioned, that's Temple's book, is really good in the workplace. The Autism Society of North Carolina, where I work, has an incredible, the largest autism-related bookstore in the world. And they have a number of books that are specifically targeting work and vocational skills. And so I would, you know, highly recommend that you go to the Autism Society of North Carolina website and go to our bookstore and browse what books are there under that topic. And you can even call the bookstore and talk to one of our staff people, and they read all the books. So they can sort of give you a synopsis of each of the books and kind of direct you towards the books that are being, you know, are most popular, that parents seem to find helpful. So that's a great resource.
I think it is, because I know that there are a few books out there that I have seen over the last few years, but I couldn't tell you the name of them. And also it depends on the specific challenges that this adult child is facing in terms of why he's afraid to go out. So
right.
Maybe to give something that he's interested in that'll overcome that fear that he has.
I know there's it's Ask and Tell, Self-Advocacy and Disclosure for People on the Autism Spectrum is Stephen Shore's book. And then there is another book called Asperger Syndrome Employment Workbook, and that one's by Roger Meyer.
Trying to remember.
Yes, that would be a good resource as well.
Good. Okay, here's Cheryl from Southwick. Is there any known financial aid other than the usual government subsidies, Pell Grants, et cetera, or scholarships for those on the autism spectrum? That's the first question, and then I'll ask the second one after that. Do you know of any special financial aid for people on the spectrum?
I know of a few. There's not a lot that I know of, but I know that there's some scholarship programs. The CVS Pharmacy does a charitable trust where I think they give a $1,000 scholarship per year to students on the spectrum, and the Autism Society of America administers this scholarship. There's also an Ohio Autism Scholarship Program that can give up to $20,000 a year if the student with autism attends a private school. And then the Eden Services also, I've heard, offer money towards a student with autism attending college. So there are different programs out there. There are not as many as there are with other disabilities, but there's a number of books out there, and I'm sorry I don't have the name of them, where you can actually look up any kind of financial aid for college students, and it would include any college student, but I believe they also have ones for specific disabilities that you may be able to access.
You would think that at the high school, somebody would be able to point those out to them.
They should. The guidance office, the guidance counselor should have that information. And actually, if they don't have it, they should be the one to help research it because, you know, they need to have that information for other students as well.
That's a good point. And the second question that Cheryl had was, how do you go about finding a college that has a program geared to those on the autism spectrum? Now, I know there's a couple of organizations that actually have colleges in certain areas that are now geared towards students with Asperger's, at least. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, I am, actually. There are two different programs that come to mind. First, the College Living Experience is one, and they have five different locations, I believe, across the country. Austin, Fort Lauderdale, I think, D.C. is one of them, Monterey and Denver. So the issue with these programs, this one and the one I'm going to mention next, is that they're quite expensive. So families need to recognize that. But I think at the College Living Experience, the tuition alone is over $33,000 a year. So it's not cheap. But what they do is offer a program that not only works towards the academic inclusion of the student on the autism spectrum in university classes, but they also work on living skills, independent living skills, self-help, social skills. So it's really a very inclusive program that covers a lot of areas. The other one that's similar is the college internship program, and they, I believe, have four locations, and one in Massachusetts and Florida, Indiana, and Berkeley, I think, is the other one. And the tuition there ranges is based on the level of support that the student needs, and it can range anywhere from close to $40,000 to over $70,000 a year, and that's just for tuition. So again, it's expensive, but it sounds like a wonderful program for families who can afford that. And then another program that's very well known in the field is Marshall University's program that they have for students with ASD. And it is an actual, it's different from these other two programs I mentioned in that it's a college. You have to be accepted into Marshall University as a Marshall University student. And then as being on the autism spectrum and getting into this particular program on campus, they offer special support for not only academic but college living. They have dormitory rooms that they supervise, and the student gets a great learning experience as well as academic support. So that is a program, a model that many colleges are looking at doing, where they have a smaller program within the university that is specifically targeting to support those students with ASD. So that would be another university that I would look into if that's the kind of program you're looking for.
Very good. Good ideas, Anne. Good resources. Okay, here's one from Bernadette Gonzalez. And if an 18-year-old high school senior does not have all the skills needed to enter college, for example, cannot write a research paper, but has the credits to graduate due to a past school issue, are there any suggestions for transition from high school to college? The student is high functioning and on the spectrum and is expecting to attend a college in September. However, he lacks the skills and follow through to complete the applications appropriately and insists on handling everything on his own and does so. You know what that's like, Anne. I mean, I don't know personally, but you've heard of people like that who think that they can do it all, but actually they can't. And how do you help somebody like that?
It's very frustrating, I'm sure, for the parents dealing with that situation. And I've seen it many, many times. And it's very discouraging. And when you know they can be helped, but they're not willing to ask for the help or accept the help. I think, unfortunately, in that kind of a situation, sometimes when you've done everything you can to advise the student to receive help or to lower their expectations or to, you know, to be more realistic about their what they can and can't do, I think, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, they have to fail to realize that they don't have the ability to do it without help. And we don't want any of our children to fail, ever. But sometimes when you've done everything you can, if they're an adult, they're their own guardian, there isn't much you can do to step in there and change things. So it's very disheartening as a parent to see that happen. But maybe not being able to get into a school because they can't follow through with the application process will be a learning moment for that student, where he'll realize, you know, take a step back and realize, okay, I need some help because it didn't work the way I wanted it to do it on my own. So, you know, I would, you know, again, be patient to try to advise as much as you can about what is important for that student to know. And sometimes look into somebody else, maybe that the student respects or cares for, maybe someone more their own age that they would take advice from better, maybe another college student, somebody who's older, been a sibling, or someone who's been through college before, to be able to give them some advice about the steps for getting in and what they might need help with. That might come easier from someone that's not mom or dad, and I would try that avenue as well.
That's a very good point. Sometimes it's very difficult for children to take advice from their parents.
Yeah.
Okay. I know going through that right now with helping my daughter, actually she's doing all her college applications, but I've insisted that I should at least just read to make sure there, or that somebody should read for the grammatical errors. Because it doesn't matter who you are, you always make mistakes when you're writing so much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but obviously it's not the same kind of situation, but I do have to say that I noticed the college applications are much more complicated than when I was doing it for myself. And I won't tell the listeners how many years ago that was.
Yeah, we won't go there. And I won't do the same.
Yeah, but it is much harder now, I have the feeling.
It is. Okay. It's much more competitive and much more stress on the student to do these applications.
Yes. Okay, Deidre Carbone in Severina Park. How do you help your child with the difficult task of organizing and keeping track of their own work? High school has been such a challenge, and the second year, and still nowhere ready for college-level application.
Well, we've touched on this a little bit already, haven't we? But I think the organizational skills are probably one of the hardest areas, and we should expect that to be a challenge for any of our kids at the college level. And I think what I mentioned earlier is the need to help that student develop a system that works for them, that they're comfortable with, that they can practice before they get to college as a way to organize themselves, doing more of what I mentioned earlier about using calendars, electronic devices to help keep track of their schedules and their appointments and things like that. So it's not going to be something overnight that's going to be fixed. And I think that's probably one reason why it's important that our students disclose to disability services at the college level, because that organizational need that so many of our students are going to have at the college level require, I think, special accommodations to get through them so that they're not holding them back from being successful in college.
Right. Okay. Here's one. We've touched on this a little bit, but I think there's more we can add here. This is from Lori in Martinsburg. My son is a sophomore in high school. What should I and the school need to be doing now to help him be prepared to attend college? He does well academically, but he struggles with social interactions, including working with others on group activities in school. Well, here I want to say one thing that I keep forgetting to bring up, but one big thing that should be started even younger, but definitely needs to be looked at in high school if they don't have it under control then, is self-regulation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a life skill that we don't hear that much talk about, but that's really, it doesn't matter whether they end up in college or work. If somebody doesn't have self-regulation over their sensory processing and their emotional stuff,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to be really hard for them either at college or at work. Don't you agree? And I'm bringing this because if you have a student who has an IEP, these are the kinds of things you want to make sure being addressed in an IEP so that it's part of a goals and objectives. Wouldn't you say, Em?
Oh, definitely. And that self-regulation, and I think how does the student deal with anxiety and stress? And if they already have those issues while they're in high school, they're going to definitely have them at the college level where things may be even more stressful. So coming up with some sort of a program, that a self-involved program where they know when they're anxious, and then they have a solution, a strategy for dealing with that anxiety and regulating themselves, being able to know the best way to calm themselves down, what they need to do, I think is extremely important. So that was a very good point. And I forgot the beginning of her question. What was she in particular asking about? Can you remind me of that?
Well, she wants to know what she and also the school should be doing now to help him be prepared to attend college, that he does well academically, but he struggles with social interactions, including working with others on group activities in school.
Okay, right. I would recommend that as much as possible to include things in the IEP where the student has to be more social, has to communicate more. So either some sort of reporting goal where the student has to come to a teacher on a regular basis and talk to them about what they're doing, reporting certain information. That's a good goal in school to kind of work towards learning how to be more socially interactive. I think what we can do as parents, number one, is respect our sons and daughters' opinions. I think we take for granted sometimes we make decisions for our kids oftentimes because it's a lot easier than going through the long process of them making the decision themselves. And so I think one thing we can do as parents is to respect the fact that they're adults and that they have feelings and that they need to be able to express those feelings and make their own decisions. And we need to step back a little bit, let them make decisions, let them, you know, the ongoing ask them their opinion or how something felt or whatever, any of those kind of interactions will give them some experience with, you know, advocating for themselves, expressing themselves, and working on some of those social interaction difficulties that this parent is mentioning in that question.
Right. Good points. Okay, Joe in Belmont. Up until this past school year, in regards to my 15-year-old Asperger's son, the school stated very loudly, you don't want to stigmatize him and make him feel even more different with special ed, do you? That's how they scared me away when I even first inquired about an evaluation for my son.
Well, you may have a similar experience or not, Chantal, but I found over the years that special education actually was a big a benefit for my son in school, and sometimes he needed more one-on-one or smaller setting to work on the skills he needed, and when he was struggling, he needed a smaller setting, and then those things he learned, those skills he learned in those special settings actually gave him the skills he needed to be fully included at a later age. So I never felt that his diagnosis stigmatized him or kept him from being able to achieve everything that he could achieve. Now, that was our personal experience, and it may be different for different parents. But I would,
It just sounds to me like the school district here is trying to avoid having taken any responsibility, you know, because I think that this parent just needs to realize that it's their right to ask for these evaluations and to put them in writing and just focus on what help that they can get for their son.
I agree. That's exactly what I was going to say. They do have the legal right. Yes.
Exactly, and it's not a stigmatism. It's what you make of it. And if it's something that's going to help you, anyway, once you're out of school, no one has access to those records except you anyway.
Right.
And so the thing that worries me is if the school has that attitude, then do all their services have that attitude, or is this one particular person?
Right.
You know, because that's, you know, that would be a concern that I would have. But I think that the parent would need to first rightfully ask in their with the letter, look up your rights on special education because you have rights, and then also know the kinds of things that would help your son because then you will know the kinds of things that you're looking for to have supports for him, because you're right in looking at this now before he leaves school.
Exactly, because those, especially in the terms of evaluations and assessments, because the colleges require current evaluations within 3 years, typically. So you shouldn't waive any evaluations when you're already, if you already have an IEP and evaluations come up and it's time for an evaluation and the school says, well, we probably don't need to do an evaluation for Tommy because we know him well and we know what works well. You need to say, yes, we do need this evaluation because it's very important to have current information as my son goes through this important transition to adult life and still have those assessments. And for somebody who is considering an evaluation and assessment, you need to have it done as soon as you can, and especially in the school setting where you don't have to pay for that evaluation, and you need to have that information to make that that important transition for the student and know exactly what they're going to need. So I agree with you that, you know, all the parent has to do is make a referral, is to ask for an evaluation, and legally they have to supply that within a certain period of time.
Yes, and every state has a protection and advocacy office. Mm-hmm. You can look online and usually, excuse me, these offices provide in plain English and also in many different languages answers to questions about the parent's rights. And that's what will help you to know the right way of doing what you need to do.
That's right.
Okay, now this is kind of a long question, but it's not necessarily just having to do with college, but I think it's an important question to answer. So you're going to listen to me reading a little bit here. It's Donna in Fairhaven. How does a middle school student get her classroom reading completed when she uses a reader device and does not want to use it in class because it makes her stand out? Do you have any suggestions of such devices that may be easier to use or less obvious to others? Some background. The school does not allow modifications to her schedule to allow her extra time in the resource room to read her reading assignments because her schedule and that of the staff only allow two times in the resource room on a six-day cycle, and it is not even on the same days of the week. We have suggested the library, but again, the school says that she has to go to all her other scheduled classes, so that leaves no extra time or staff to read in the library. They have not made any accommodations to allow for her reading, so they just keep reducing the amount of information she needs to know or read. She does not have a reader at home, but can listen to some of her texts on CDs provided by RFBD, but only if the school assigns the reading and trains her on how to locate the reading assignment on the CD and allows her to bring home the RFBD recorder and player. This has not happened either. So as an included student, she has generally not had access to all her texts except when it is read aloud by her teachers in class. Do you have any suggestions on what the school should be doing in order to provide a way that she can have access to the same amount and type of information as her classmates? Her inclusion in the regular classrooms and according to the standard schedule is providing her with a limited education. She would have access to more textbooks and other educational materials if she were allowed to go into another learning environment during some of her regular ed classes and to do the reading with the staff or limited number of other students who have difficulty with reading, dyslexia, print disability.
Well, I think you're probably more knowledgeable, Chantal, about the different technical devices that are can be helpful to students. But it sounds to me from this parent's question that the school is not her rights are being violated. You know, her child's rights are being violated in that they can't lessen her educational curriculum because they don't have staff available to help her with the reading, or that they can't
right.
fit in a time for that. So it doesn't sound to me like I don't know what's in this student's IEP, but it needs to be in the IEP what the student needs to be successful, and I think the school has to follow that and not limit the amount of educational exposure that the student has because it doesn't fit into a schedule. They have to make the schedule work for this individual student. So I would suggest she talk to an advocate, and I don't know which state. Is this in California? I'm not sure what the system is there.
She says it says Fairhaven, but I don't know what state that is. But, again, every state has protection and advocacy.
Right.
And so if you don't have access to an advocate, that's what I would do. But the thing that concerns me here, too, is that they're not allowing you to have the equipment to take home. And it's interesting because I gave a talk in a presentation in New York, in upstate New York in the fall, and I was really surprised to find out that many of the students there leave their assistive technology devices, their augmentative communication devices,
mm-hmm.
at the school. They're not allowed to take them home.
Oh, that's
and
ridiculous.
How can you do that? That's like taking somebody's wheelchair away from them.
Right. Well,
so I have concerns that because the law is that If these are what you need to get your education, then you should have access to it.
I agree, totally. Yeah, there needs to be some more communication with the school about this, and if the parent needs to read up on their rights and their child's rights, and also maybe if they need an advocate with them at a meeting to help them advocate for their child, they should do that. But it sounds like there are definitely some options that are not being offered here that could make this problem go away.
Well, I wish that person luck, but really you can't give up. You're going to have to insist on the school giving that your child access. I mean, it's such a waste because they need to be doing what's right for her.
I agree.
This is Elsie in Newburgh. My son is 10 years old, and his teacher has told me that they see him going to college. However, only one teacher is actually working with him. She now has him doing second and third grade spelling, math, and some global studies. What do I have to do to encourage his primary teacher to work towards him being mainstreamed?
That's a good question, too. I think, you know, when you have a student on the autism spectrum who has a lot of skills, and sometimes teachers look at their grades or their performance academically and see a certain thing and sort of don't see underlying difficulties, social difficulties, communication difficulties. So oftentimes that's why we often have to be such strong advocates for our kids, to make sure the teachers understand their challenges and their strengths and what they're capable of doing. And I think it sounds like this teacher needs some more awareness, not only about what that student's skills, her son's skills are and abilities are, but also maybe about the autism spectrum and what is possible. I don't know what trainings are offered at this particular school for the teachers, but I would, you know, oftentimes a teacher may have limited knowledge about issues related to ASD, and they think they know because they may have worked with one other student in the past with ASD, and therefore that worked for that student, so it will for this one. So it sounds to me like maybe the teacher needs a little more knowledge about
the
spectrum.
And the other thing that I want to mention is because they talk about, or this parent talks about, having the child mainstreamed. Well, the child does not have to be caught up at the same level as everyone in his class in terms of the academics to be mainstreamed.
Mm-hmm.
Every student has the right. In fact, the schools have to show why the child is not being taught in regular education. So, for example, even for years before we knew what my son was capable of understanding, he had a little bit of speech, a little bit of PECs, but we didn't know what he was understanding. I insisted, and it was in his IEP, that he would go to two mainstream classes a day. And I did that. I was not allowed, I could not base that on an academic need, but I based it on a social need, because in my opinion, I didn't know, and I didn't really, it's not that I didn't care, but I mean, my son was going to do the best that he could do, whatever his potential was. But I know that he was always going to live in society. And in society, what do you need to do? You have to learn to sit, and you have to learn to wait. And I thought, be with a group of people, and I thought he needs to go and sit in these classrooms and be with people, and at least maybe he can learn by watching what they're doing as well. And so it's a good thing that I did that, because that's why my son, now that he's able to communicate, can communicate that he knows so much, because he remembers he learned everything when he was sitting in these classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another thing, is your child may be able to pick up. And so even if they argue with you that he's not academically ready, it doesn't matter, because he can be catching up with the academic work in the classroom. It's all based on the goals and objectives. And so I don't think you need to wait for him to catch up to have some form of mainstreaming. Don't you agree, Anne?
I do. And unfortunately, with the overworked teachers and the large class size and everything else that teachers
right.
deal with. We often see less support for mainstreaming because, frankly, it takes time. It takes someone's work. Someone needs to go with that student into that classroom, and maybe they don't feel like they have time to do that. But it goes back to the protections under IDEA for that individual child. What does that child need to be successful? And if going into a mainstream setting, be exposed to not just the academics, but as you were discussing, some of the classroom behaviors and the things, the social piece of being mainstreamed, every child has a right to do that, and they can't say, we can't do it because we don't have the time. That's not an option. And I think it sounds like this, this parent may need to advocate a little bit harder for that, like you did, in encouraging that mainstream experience, if that is what her son really needs.
I know it's so hard because we have to be advocating all the time. I did want to say, because I sound like I'm being really strong about this, I always advocate, but I always advocate in a nice way. I've always been assertive, not aggressive.
That's very important.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing we spend a lot of time educating I supervise parent advocates across the state at the Autism Society, and we spend a lot of time talking to parents about how to make your point in a way that is supportive and not condescending, or you have to go into a relationship with a teacher or a principal or whoever it may be, respecting their job and the stresses that come with their job, and then hopefully they also respect where you're coming from and what your concerns and fears are for your son or daughter. And it's definitely a relationship you have to work on, and I think you're right, advocating can be done, very strong advocating can be done with the support of the teacher, with at the same time you're telling the teacher you love how she teaches and you're supportive of what she's doing in the classroom, but you're also advocating for what your child needs.
And a lot of times too, it could be that the teacher agrees, but the teacher doesn't have the supports, but the teacher does not have the power that a parent does. A parent at an IEP meeting can request these things that gets written in the IEP if everyone's in agreement on the team, and therefore then they must supply the person who's going to accompany a child to mainstreaming if that extra support is needed. A teacher cannot necessarily ask for that. The school district will say, well, we don't have the money, but they're not allowed to say that to a parent. If the team agrees that this would be beneficial for the student, then they need to provide that person. And so oftentimes I've talked to the teacher to find out, what does the teacher need to give my child the education that the teacher believes he should be receiving? And how can I help the teacher? And oftentimes it has meant at an IEP of me bringing up and asking for supports that the teacher can't ask for.
Right. And so we can benefit, we can actually help them advocate for what they need for their students in their classroom. I agree. It's a wonderful part. It can work really well as a partnership if you work together.
Exactly. Okay, here's a question from Denise in Whittier. I have a sixth grade student who has difficulty during social interaction with peers. Student has a difficult time when she loses a game and believes everyone hates her. Are there any strategies that you used that assisted your son with interpersonal skills? I know that's not really a college question, but I mean, it's preparing for the future.
Yeah, I think it applies as well. It can be you could be talking about an elementary school student going through an experience like that or something similar at the college level. I think it's individualized because all of our children are different. Personally, my son is one of these individuals on the autism spectrum who is not very social, and he's okay with that. He doesn't care that he doesn't have best friends. He never cared that he wasn't invited to the party that they were talking about at school, or, he was not feeling excluded or left out, and I think of that as a blessing sometimes that he was not feeling badly about not being a part of the mainstream totally. But a lot of our students and our kids are really anxious to be social and to be accepted and really struggle to have those interpersonal relationships. I think social stories, Carol Gray's social stories, are, if that's appropriate for the student, can be a wonderful way of trying to teach other people's perspectives. And I found a lot of parents I know have used those in developing social skills. And I don't know if this particular parent has social groups available in their community, but I never found that just putting my son in a mainstream setting with other kids doing a social activity was necessarily going to be beneficial, because he really needed more. He needed it to be simpler and broken down and a little more structured. And he could be very social if he knew ahead of time what he was going to have to do, or there was some sort of a script, or it was a smaller setting of kids and things like that. So I would also look into any kind of speech therapy or OT therapy service in the community that might do social skills training, because many of them will do the small group kind of social interpersonal skills. So those are some of the options. I'm not sure. And also I found that siblings are a great way to try to teach some of these social awkwardness, these skills that these students are going to need, using their own siblings, but also siblings of people on the autism spectrum can be much more patient, say, with another child with autism, because they've lived with their own sibling on the spectrum and understand it a little bit. So I would look for informal kind of social settings to work on some of these skills.
Very good point. Now, we only have a few minutes left, and it looks like there's a few people that hooked on late that are asking questions that we've already repeated. So I'm just going to ask you to summarize, because one of the questions, for example, is from Michelle in Santa Clarita. I would like to know if there is an IEP as well in college for kids with Asperger's, as well as there is in grammar school. Janice in Arizona says, what type of classroom is a child with Asperger's going to have? Are they included in a regular type class? Marie in Los Angeles says, what kinds of colleges accept kids with Asperger's? So if you could just summarize in a couple minutes what you've been saying about, you know, the IEP versus ADA.
Okay. Well, first of all, at the college level, a student cannot be discriminated against with any disability. So they can't not accept a student simply based on the fact that they have a diagnosis. However, they can not accept a student because they don't meet the criteria that is set for all students to get into that college. So that's the difference. And at the college level, there is no IEP. And actually, the IEP at the high school level is rarely even looked at by the college at the time of talking to disability services and trying to get accommodations. They really aren't looking at that information. They're looking for a current diagnostic evaluation, fairly current, within 3 years, that by a professional who describes the actual disability and how it affects that student. And based on that, that student will or won't qualify for certain accommodations at the college level. So those are the, and again, the parent's role in that, again, the student, the emphasis is going to be on the student asking for the accommodations, being able to describe why they need help, what their diagnosis is. All of that is going to be done through the student and not through the parent.
Great. Very good summary there, Ann. So my guest this evening has been Ann Palmer. And Ann, will you please repeat again the names of your books and also where they can get information on you, for example, your website?
Thank you. Yes. one of the books, the one I spoke about mostly tonight, is Realizing the College Dream with Autism or Asperger's Syndrome. And then the other book that is specifically written for parents and supporting parents going through this journey is Parenting Across the Autism Spectrum, and it was authored by Maureen Morrell and myself. And my website is www.annpalmer autism, and that's all one word, .com. And you can find information about my books and some articles there, and be able to contact me through that website if you have any other questions.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Hold on, okay? Don't go away.
Okay.
I'm going to ask listeners if they have any feedback to please call 877-211-0212 and to press 1. I'm going to repeat the number. You can give your feedback on 877-211-0212 and then press 1. I also want to tell listeners that our next guest for our next webinar is going to be Dr. Carl Hillier of the San Diego Center for Vision Care, and his topic will be vision therapy, vision and living within the autistic spectrum. That will be on February 18th. So February 18th, we'll be talking about vision therapy and vision processing, which is really important to learning. And many of our students on the spectrum have challenges in those areas. And so I want to thank again Anne. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chantal.
And to all our listeners there, I hope you'll listen in again next month on February 18th. And until then, live the life that you want to, and actually create the life that you would like to live in.